time for the Sunday Play.
The Invention of Love by Tom Stoppard, with John Wood as A.E. Houseman and Ben Porter as the young Houseman. The Invention of Love.
I'm dead then.
Good. And this is the Stygian gloom one has heard so much about.
Belay the painter there, sir.
Belay the painter, the tongues of men and of angels.
See the cleat? I trust you had grieving friends and family, sir, to give you a decent burial.
Cremation? But very decent, I believe. A service at Trinity College, and the ashes laid to rest, for fathomable reasons, in Shropshire. A county where I never lived and seldom set foot.
So long as the wolves and bears don't dig you up.
No fear of that. The jackals are another matter. One used to say, after I'm dead. The consolation is not as complete as one had supposed. There, the painter is belayed. I heard Ruskin lecture in my first term at Oxford. Painters belayed on every side. He died mad, as you may have noticed. Are we waiting for someone?
He's late. I hope nothing's happened to him. What do they call you, sir?
Alfred Houseman is my name. My friends call me Houseman. My enemies call me Professor Houseman. And now you're going to ask me for a coin. And regrettably, the custom of putting a coin in the mouth of the deceased is foreign to the Evelyn nursing home and probably against the rules. Doubly late. Are you sure?
A poet and a scholar is what I was told.
I think that must be me.
Both of them?
I'm afraid so.
It sounded like two different people.
I know.
Give him a minute.
To collect myself. Ooh, look, I found a sixpence. Mint, 1936 Anno Domini.
You know Latin.
Well, I should say I do. I am, well, was, for 25 years, Benjamin Hall Kennedy Professor of Latin at Cambridge. Is Kennedy here? I should like to meet him.
Everyone is here. And those that aren't will be.
Well, I don't suppose I'll have time to meet everybody.
Yes, you will. But Benjamin Hall Kennedy isn't usually first choice.
Well, I didn't mean to suggest that he is mine. He imputed to the practice of translation into Greek and Latin verse a value which it does not really possess. At least not as an insight into the principles of ancient metre. It stands to reason you're not likely to discover the laws of meter by composing verses in which you occasionally break those laws because you have not yet discovered them. But Kennedy was a schoolmaster. A schoolmaster of genius, but a schoolmaster. It was only in an outbreak of sentimentality that Cambridge named a chair after him. I would have countenanced a small inkpot. Even so, let it be said, it is to Kennedy, or more directly to his Sabrinae Corolla, the third edition, which I received as a school prize when I was 17, that I owe my love of Latin and Greek. In Greek, I am, as it were, an amateur, and know hardly more than the professors. Well, a great deal more than Pearson, who knew more than Jowett and Jebb combined. As Regius Professor of Greek when I was at Oxford, Jowett was contaminated by misplaced enthusiasm for classical education, which to him meant supplying the governing classes with Balliol men who had read some Plato, or with Oxford men who had read some Plato when Balliol men who had read some Plato were not available. In my first week, which was in October 1877, I heard Jowett pronounce Akribos with the accent on the first syllable, and I thought, woohoo, so much for Jowett. With Jeb, it was Sophocles. There are places in Jeb Sophocles where the responsibility for reading the meter seems to have been handed over to the Gaslight and Coke Company.
Could you keep quiet for a bit?
Yes, I expect so. My life was marked by long silences.
Sit in the middle.
Of course.
Who is usually first choice?
Helen of Troy. You'll see a three-headed dog when we've crossed over. If you don't take any notice of him, he won't take any notice of you.
Yea, we have been forsaken in the wilderness to gather grapes of thorns and figs of thistles.
Pull on your right, Jackson.
Do you want to take the oars?
No, you're doing splendidly.
House hasn't done any work since Ifly.
No.
The nerve of it. Who brought you up from Hades? To say nothing of the dog.
The dog says nothing of you. The dog loves Jackson. Jackson loves the dog. The uninflected dog, the uninflected Jackson loves. That's the beauty of it.
What a good dog.
The uninflected dog can't be good. Dogs have no soul.
What did he say?
He said your dog has no soul.
What a cheat.
Well, it just goes to show you don't know much about dogs. Nothing at all about Jackson's dog, whose soul is already bespoke to the Elysian Fields, where it is eagerly awaited by many of his friends. Who are not gone, but only sleeping. But the pull on your right, Jackson.
Not dead, only dreaming.
Well, I never. Brought their own boat. Whatever next.
I don't need to stretch out my hand. Ripa ulterioris amores.
Oh, Mo. I would have died for you, but I never had the luck.
The dog? My greatest friend and comrade, Moses Jackson.
Neclithaya walet fesius avrumperi caro vincula pidis o'o. That's right. I remember him, Theseus, trying to break the chains that held fast his friend to take him back with him from the underworld. But it can't be done, sir. It can't be done.
What is trochum?
A hoop in the accusative.
Neque volvere?
Yes, we're forbidden by the university statutes to trundle a hoop. I'm Pollard. I believe we have the two open scholarships this year. May I offer my congratulations?
Well, how do you do? Well, congratulations to you too.
Where were you at school?
The Vale Academy. It's in Ramsgate. Actually, my father is the principal. But I haven't come from school. I've been 2 years at University College London. I did a bit of rowing there, actually. And you?
King's College School.
You play rugby, don't you?
Yes. Well, not personally.
I prefer rugby football to association rules. I wonder if the college turns out a strong side. I don't count myself a serious cricketer, though I can put in a useful knock on occasion. Field athletics is probably what I'll concentrate on in Easter Town.
Ah, so long as it's not trundling a hoop.
No, I'm a runner first and foremost, I suppose. The quarter mile and the half mile are my best distances.
So you're keen on sport?
One is at Oxford to work, of course. But, as the poet says, all work and no
play. Random est ut sit mens sano in corpore sano.
Makes Jack a dull boy.
I didn't realise the classics scholarship was open to university men.
Classics? No, that's not me. I have the science scholarship.
Science? Well, sorry. How do you do?
I'm Jackson.
Pollard. Congratulations. That explains it.
What?
I don't know. Yes, Trochus. Comes into Ovid or Horace somewhere. The satires.
The odes. Sorry. Ode 3:24.
Ludere doctior su graeco ubias trocho. It's where he's saying everything's gone to the dogs.
Oh, yes, that's it. High-born young men can't sit on a horse and are afraid to hunt. They're better at playing with the Greek hoop.
Now, actually, trochos is Greek. It's the Greek word for hoop. So when Horace uses graecus trochos, it's rather like saying French chapeau. Well, I mean, he's laying it on thick, isn't he?
Is he? What?
Well, to a Roman, to call something Greek meant very often Sicily-like or effeminate. In fact, a hoop, a trochus, was a favourite gift given by a Greek man to the boy he, you know, to his favourite boy.
Oh, beastliness, you mean?
This is Mr. Jackson, by the way.
How do you do, sir?
I say, I'm a freshman too, you know. Have you seen the board where you put your name down? I'm going to try out for the Torpids next term. Perhaps I'll see you at the...
Yes, at dinner.
The river?
River. A science scholar.
Seems quite decent, though.
I'm Pollard.
A houseman. We're on the same staircase.
No, spiffing. Where were you at school?
Bromsgrove. It's in... Well, Bromsgrove, in fact. It's a place in Worcestershire.
I was at King's College School. That's in London.
I've been to London. I went to the Albert Hall and the British Museum. The best thing was the guards, though.
You were right about Ovid, by the way. Trochus is an Arzam.
Oh.
My young friends, I am very grieved to tell you that if you have come up to Oxford with the idea of getting knowledge, you must give that up at once. We have bought you. And we're running you in two plates, mods and the finals.
Yes, sir.
The curriculum is designed on the idle plan that all of knowledge will be found inside the covers of four Latin and four Greek books, though not the same four each year.
Thank you, sir.
A genuine love of learning is one of the two delinquencies which cause blindness and lead a young man to ruin.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Hopeless. Thank you for sending me your photograph, dear boy. And also for your sonnet, of course. But why do you always write poetry? Why don't you write prose? Prose is so much more difficult.
No one has written the poetry I wish to write, Mr. Pater. But you have already written the prose.
That is charmingly said. I will look at your photograph more carefully when I get home.
I was 17 when I came up to Oxford. That was in 1836, and the word Eastfeet was unknown. Aesthetics was newly arrived from Germany, but there was no suggestion that it involved dressing up, as it might be the London Fire Brigade, nor that it was connected in some way with that excessive admiration for male physical beauty which conduced to the fall of Greece. No, George. It wasn't until the 1860s that moral degeneracy came under the baleful protection of artistic license and advertised itself as aesthetic. Before that, unnatural behavior like sodomy in football was generally left behind at school.
Yes, Dr. Ruskin, I was considered very beautiful at school. I had golden curls. The other boys called me Miss Jewett. The torment, the humiliation. My body ached from the indignities. I used to run away whenever the ball came near me. No one now, I think, calls me Miss Jarrett or Mistress of Balliol.
False quantities in all around I see. Yea, we have been forsaken in the wilderness to gather grapes of thorns and figs of thistles.
That's possibly why the college is named for John the Baptist.
John the Baptist was locust and wild honey, actually, Pollard.
Well, it's the Baptist school of hard knocks. First the wilderness, then the head on the platter.
It was clear something was amiss from the day we matriculated. The statutes warned us against drinking, gambling, and hoop trundling. Not a word about Jowett's translation of Plato. The Regius Professor can't even pronounce the Greek language, and there is no one at Oxford to tell him.
Except you, Houseman.
I will take his secret to the grave. Telling people I meet on the way. Betrayal is no sin if it's whimsical.
We did the new pronunciation, you know. As an Englishman, I never took to the speaking of it. Wainy, weedy, weaky. It was never natural to my mind.
Oh, that was Latin, actually, Jackson.
And Venus, the goddess of love, I mean to say.
Perhaps I don't make myself plain. Latin and Greek are two entirely separate languages, spoken by distinct peoples living in different parts of the ancient world.
Some inkling of this must have got through to you, Jackson, at the Vale Academy Ramsgate, surely.
Oh, but Venus, the goddess of love, for a man of Jackson's venereal pursuits, is a strong objection to the new pronunciation. Where is the chemistry in Venus?
I know you and Pollard look down on science.
Is it a science? Ovid said it was an art.
Oh, love! You're just ragging me because you've never kissed a girl.
Well, what's it like, Jackson?
But kissing girls is not like science, nor is it like sport. It's the third thing when you thought there were only two.
God. Dame basia mille, dende kentum.
Catullus,
give me 1,000 kisses, then 100, then another 1,000, then a second 100. Yes, Catullus is Jackson's sort of poet.
How does it go? Is it suitable for sending to Miss Little as my own work?
That depends how she scans. Does she go dum-diddy?
Very much doubted. She's the daughter of the Dean of Christchurch.
She has to scan with lesbia. All Catullus's love poems were written to Lesbia, or about her. We warmus me lesbiaque amem.
I mean in English. Girls who kiss don't know Latin.
Oh, in English. Well, come on, Hausman. Let us live, my Lesbia, and let us love and value at one penny the murmurs of disapproving old men.
Yeah, and not give tuppence for the mutterance of old men's tutterance.
He's such a show-off. Well, go on. As soles occidere.
Suns can set and rise again. When our brief light is gone, we sleep the sleep of perpetual night. Give me 1,000 kisses.
But what happens in the end?
In the end, they're both dead, and Catullus is set for moderations.
Well, did they get married?
But no, they loved and quarrelled and made up, and loved and fought, and were true to each other and untrue. But she made him the happiest man in the whole world, and the most wretched. And then a few years later, she died. And then when he was 30, he died too. But by that time, Catullus had invented the love poem.
He invented it? Did he, House?
Well... you don't have to ask him. Like everything else. Like clocks and trousers and algebra, the love poem had to be invented. After millenniums of sex and centuries of poetry, the love poem, as understood by Shakespeare and Donne and by Oxford undergraduates, the true life confessions of the poet in love, immortalizing the mistress, who is actually the cause of the poem, that was invented in Rome in the first century before Christ.
Gosh!
Bassium is a point of interest. Kitts was always Osculum until Catullus.
Oh, now concentrate, House. Is that the point of interest in the kiss?
Yes.
Well, pull on your right, Jackson.
Do you want to take the oars?
No, you're doing splendidly.
House hasn't done any work since below Ifrit.
The nerve of it! Who brought us up from Hades? Say nothing of the dog.
I was not quite 17 when I first saw Oxford. That was in 1830, and Oxford was delightful then, not the overbuilt slum it has become. Mm-hmm. The town teems with people who have no business here, which is to say, business is all they have. The university held off the London and Birmingham Railway until the 40s, and I said at the time, if the Birmingham train comes, can the London train be far behind?
I don't think that can be quite right, Dr. Patterson.
Posting 10 miles to Steventon for the Paddington train was never anything to cherish. And personally, I thank God for the branch line and hope his merciful bounty is not exhausted by changing a Dipcot.
When I am at Paddington, I feel I am in hell.
Oh, you must not go about telling everyone, Dr. Ruskin. It will not do for the moral education of Oxford undergraduates that the wages of sin may be no more than a sense of being stranded at one of the larger railway stations.
To be morally educated is to realize that such would be a terrible price. Mechanical advance is the slack taken up of our failing humanity. Mm. Hell is very likely to be modernization infinitely extended. There is a rocky valley between Buxton and Bakewell where once you may have seen at first and last light the muses dance for Apollo and heard the panpipes play. But its rocks were blasted away for the railway, and now every fool in Buxton can be at Bakewell in half an hour, and every fool in Bakewell at Buxton.
Personally, I am in favour of education, but a university is not the place for it.
Oh.
A university exists to seek the meaning of life by the pursuit of scholarship.
I have announced the meaning of life in my lectures. There is nothing beautiful which is not good, and nothing good which has no moral purpose. I had my students up at dawn, building a flower-bordered road across a swamp at Ferry Hinksey. There was an Irish exquisite, a great slab of a youth with white hands and long, poetical hair, who said he was glad to say he'd never seen a shovel. But I made him a navvy for one term, and I taught him that the work of one's hands is the beginning of virtue. Then I went sketching to Venice, and the road sank into the swamp. My protege rose at noon to smoke cigarettes and read French novels, and Oxford reverted to a Cockney watering place for learning to row.
Come on, St. John's! Ruskin said, when he's at Paddington, he feels he is in hell.
And this man, Oscar Wilde, said, ah, but when he's in hell, he'll think he's only a Paddington. It'll be a pity if inversion is all he's known for. Row up, St. John's!
You hate sport.
Keep the stroke!
But Wilde is reckoned the wittiest man at Oxford. His rooms at Magdalen are said to be completely bare, except for a lily in a blue vase.
No furniture.
Of course there is furniture.
Come on, St. John's!
I suppose there is furniture.
Well, he went to the Morrill's Ball in a velvet Prince Rupert costume, which he has absent-mindedly put on every morning since, and has been seen wearing it in the High. But everyone is repeating his remark that he finds it harder and harder every day to live up to his blue china. Don't you think that's priceless?
We have a blue china butter dish at Bromsgrove. We never take any notice of it.
Oh. Well, Rhodes, St. John's, bad luck!
I was 18 when I came up to Oxford. That was in 1835, and Oxford was an utter disgrace. Education rarely interfered with the life of the university. Learning was carried on in nooks and corners, like papism in an Elizabethan manor house. The fellows were socially negligible and perfectly astonished by the historical process that had placed the teaching of undergraduates into the hands of amiable clergymen, waiting for preferment to a country parsonage. Yeah, I say nothing against the undergraduates. Debauched and indolent rabble, as it happens. The great reform of the 50s laid the foundation for the educated class, which has spread moral and social order to parts of the world where, well, take one example. My Plato was formerly quite unknown.
The great reform made us into a cramming shop.
We must send out men fitted for the modern age.
No.
What better example can we show than classical antiquity? Nowhere was the ideal of morality, art, and social order realized more harmoniously than in Greece, in the age of the great philosophers.
Buggery apart. Actually, Italy, in the late 15th century, nowhere was the ideal of art, morality, and social order realized more harmoniously. Morality and social order apart.
The medieval Gothic. The medieval Gothic cathedrals, which were the great engines of art, morality, and social order.
I have been touched by the medieval, but its moment has passed, and now I wouldn't return the compliment with a barge pole. As for arts and crafts, it is very well for the people. Without it, liberties would be at risk. In fact, it would be closed. But the true aesthetic spirit goes back to Florence, Venice, Rome, Japanese apart. One sees it plain in Michelangelo's David, legs apart. The blue of my very necktie declares that we are still living in that revolution whereby man regained possession of his nature and produced the Italian tumescence.
Renaissance, surely.
On the frescoed walls of Santa Maria della Grazia and the painted ceiling of St. Pancras.
Peter's, surely.
Well rowed, Jackson. I'm afraid they had the measure of us.
Extraordinary thing. Fellow in velvet knickerbockers, like something from the halls, came up and said he wished to compliment me on my race. I replied with dignity, "Thank you, but although my first name happens to be Moses, I'm not Jewish and can take no merit from it." He said, "Allow me to do the jokes, is what I'm at Oxford for. I saw you in the Torpids, and your left leg is a poet."
What did you say?
Well, naturally, I asked him if he was a rowing man. He said he tried out once for an oar in the Magdalen boat, but couldn't see the use of going backwards down to Iffley every evening, so he gave it up, and now plays no outdoor games at all except dominoes. He has sometimes played dominoes outside French cafes. Do you know what I think he is?
What?
I think he's one of those aesthetes.
Conscience, faith, discipline, restraint, fidelity to nature. All the Christian virtues that gave us the cathedral at Chartres, the paintings of Giotto, the poetry of Dante, have been tricked out in iridescent rags to catch the attention of the moment.
In the young Raphael, in the sonnets of Michelangelo, in Correggio's Lilybearer, in the cathedral at Parma, and ever so faintly in my necktie, we feel the touch of a... what shall I say?
Barge pole?
Barge pole, no. The touch of a refined and comely paganism that rescued beauty from the charnel house of the Christian conscience.
The Renaissance teaches us the ecstasy of living each moment for the moment's sake. Success in life is to burn always with this hard, gem-like flame. Failure is to form habits. To burn with a gem-like flame is to capture the awareness of each moment and for that moment only. To form habits is to be absent from those moments. How may we always be present for them? To garner not the fruits of experience, but experience itself. To catch at the exquisite passion, the strange flower, or art, or the face of one's friend. For not to do so in our short day of frost and sun is to sleep before evening. The conventional morality, which requires of us the sacrifice of any one of those moments, has no real claim on us. The love of art for art's sake seeks nothing in return except the highest quality to the moments of your life, and simply for those moments' sake.
Mr. Pater, can you spare a moment?
Certainly. As many as you like.
1 minute, 58 seconds.
What?
1:58 exactly.
That's nonsense.
Or 2:58.
That's nonsense the other way. What was the first quarter?
I'm afraid I forgot to look.
But what were you doing?
Watching you.
You duffer.
Well, why can't it do 1:58?
The world record for the half is over 2 minutes.
Oh. Congratulations, Jackson.
What will become of you, Hans?
It has become of me.
The story has been grossly exaggerated. It has, if you will, a crude grossness in the telling. But when all's said and done, a letter signed yours lovingly...
Yes, several letters, and addressed to an undergraduate.
Several letters signed yours lovingly, and addressed to an undergraduate...
Of Balliol.
Even of Balliol do not prove beastliness. Would hardly support a suggestion of spooniness. In fact...
From a tutor, sir. A fellow not even of his own college, thanking him for a disgusting sonnet.
You feel, in short, Dr. Jarrett, that I have overstepped the mark.
I feel, Mr. Pater, that letters to an undergraduate signed yours lovingly, thanking him for a sonnet on the honeyed mouth and lissome thighs of Ganymede, would be capable of a construction fatal to the ideals of higher learning, even if the undergraduate in question were not colloquially known as the Balliol bugger.
You astonish me.
The Balliol bugger, I am assured.
No, I am astonished that you should take exception to an obviously platonic enthusiasm.
A platonic enthusiasm, as far as Plato was concerned, meant an enthusiasm of the kind that would empty the public schools and fill the prisons where it is not nipped in the bud. In my translation of the Phaedrus, it required all my ingenuity to rephrase his depiction of paederastia into the affectionate regard as exists between an Englishman and his wife. Plato would have made the transposition himself if he'd had the good fortune to be a Balliol man.
And yet, Master, no amount of ingenuity can dispose of boy love as the distinguishing feature of a society which we venerate as one of the most brilliant in the history of human culture, raised far above its neighbours in moral and mental distinction.
You're very kind, but one undergraduate is hardly a distinguishing feature, and I have written to his father to remove him. Pack your bags, sir, and be gone. The canker that brought low the glory that was Greece shall not prevail over Balliol.
It's a long story, but there is a wash, and it will all come out in it.
I am houseman, sir, of St. John's.
Then I am at a loss to understand why I should be addressing you. Who is your tutor?
I go to Mr. Warren at Magdalen 3 times a week.
That must be it. Warren is a Balliol man. He has spoken of you. He believes you capable of great things.
Really, sir?
If you can rid yourself of your levity and your cynicism, and find another way to dissimulate your Irish provincialism than by making affected remarks about your blue china and going about in plum-coloured velvet breeches, which you don't, and cut your hair. You're not him at all, are you? Never mind. What have you got there? Oh, Munro's Catullus. I glanced at it in Blackwell's. A great deal of Munro, precious little Catullus. It's amazing what people will pay 4 shillings and 6 pence for. Catullus on your reading list?
Yes, sir. The Marriage of Peleus and Thetis.
Yeah, Catullus 64. Lord Leighton should paint that opening scene. The flower of the young men of Argos, hot for the capture of the Golden Fleece, churning the waves with their blades of pine, the first ship ever to plough the ocean. and the wild faces of the sea nymphs emerge from the white foaming waters. Emissary, ferry, condentia, gurgate, bulfus, equordiae.
Yes, sir. Fretti, actually, sir.
What?
Monroe concurs that ferry is a mistake for fretti, sir, because Wotus must be accusative.
And concurs with whom?
Concurs with, well, everybody.
Everybody but Catullus. Oh, the textual critics have spoken. Yeah, here we are. Frete for ferry is an easy correction, as R, T, TR, RT are among the letters most frequently confounded in the manuscripts. Monroe is entitled to concur with everyone who amends the manuscripts of Catullus according to his tastes, and calls his tastes his conjectures. It's a futile business, suitable to occupy the leisure of professors of Cambridge University. But you, sir, have not been put on earth with an Oxford scholarship, so that you may bother your head with whether Catullus at such and such a place wrote ut, or et, or out, or none of them, or whether such and such a line is spurious, or corrupt, or, on the contrary, an example of Catullus's peculiar genius. You're here to take the ancient authors as they come from a reputable English printer and to study them until you can write in the meter. If you cannot write Latin and Greek verse, how can you hope to be of any use in the world?
But isn't it of use, sir, to establish what the ancient authors really wrote?
It would be, on the whole, desirable, rather than undesirable. And the job was pretty well done where it could be done by good scholars dead these 100 years and more. For the rest, certainty could only come from recovering the autograph. Yeah. This morning, I had cause to have typewritten an autograph letter I wrote to the father of a certain undergraduate. The copy, as I received it, asserted that the Master of Balliol had a solemn duty to stamp out unnatural mice. In other words, anyone with a secretary knows that what Catullus really wrote was already corrupt by the time it had been copied twice, which was about the time of the first Roman invasion of Britain. And the earliest copy that has come down to us was written about 1,500 years after that. Think of all those secretaries. Corruption breeding corruption from papyrus to papyrus, and from the last disintegrating scrolls to the first newfangled parchment books, with 1,000 years of copying out still to come. Running the gauntlet of changing forms of script and spelling and absence of punctuation, not to mention mildew. And rats and fire and flood and Christian disapproval to the brink of extinction. As what Catullus really wrote passed from scribe to scribe. This one drunk, that one sleepy, another without scruple. And of those sober, wide awake and scrupulous, some ignorant of Latin. And some, even worse, fancying themselves better Latinists than Catullus. Until, finally, and at long last, mangled and tattered like a dog that has fought its way home, there falls across the threshold of the Italian Renaissance the sole surviving witness to 30 generations of carelessness and stupidity, the Verona Codex of Catullus, which was almost immediately lost again, but not before being copied with one last opportunity for error. And there you have the foundation for the poems of Catullus as they went to the printer for the first time in Venice 400 years ago.
Where, sir?
In here.
You mean, sir, that it's here, in Oxford?
Why, yes. That is why it is called the Codex Oxoniensis. Only recently was its importance recognized by a German scholar who made the Oxoniensis the foundation for his edition of the poet. Mr. Robinson Ellis of Trinity College discovered its existence several years before, but unluckily, not its importance. Awfully hard cheese, Ellis, ignoring your Oxoniensis.
Didn't ignore it.
Didn't.
And anyway, Behrens overvalued it. So there.
That's Robinson Ellis. He's somewhat altered in appearance, but the intellect is unmistakable.
Young man, they tell me that you are an absolutely safe first. I am proposing to form a class next term to read the Monobiblos. The fee will be £1.
The Monobiblos?
I've seen him before, too.
Dear me. Propertius? Book one?
Propertius?
The greatest of the Roman love elegists. And the most corrupt.
Oh!
Only Catullus has a later text. But I would say Propertius is the more corrupt.
Oh, corrupt. Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Do you know Propertius?
You mean personally?
I mean the poem.
Ah, no. Here we are, Elysium.
Elysium. Oh, where else? I was 18 when I first saw Oxford, and Oxford was charming then. Not the trippery emporium it has become. There were horse buses at the station to meet the Birmingham train, and not a brick to be seen before the Kinema and Cardoma. The Oxford of my dreams. Re-dreamt, the desire to urinate combined with the sense that it would not be a good idea usually means we're asleep.
Or in a boat. That happened to me once.
Were you asleep?
No, I was in a play. Aristophanes the Frogs.
You speak the truth. I saw you.
I had that Dionysus in the back of my boat.
You were very good.
No, I was just in it. I was caught short. Good stuff, the Frogs, don't you think?
Not particularly. But it quotes from Aeschylus.
Ah, now, that was a play.
What was?
Aeschylus Myrmidones. Do you know it?
It didn't survive. Only the title and some fragments. I would join Sisyphus in Hades and gladly push my boulder up the slope if only each time it rolled back down I were given a line from Aeschylus Myrmidones.
I think I can remember some of it.
Oh, my goodness.
Give me a minute.
Oh, my Lord.
Achilles is in his tent.
Oh, please don't let it be a dream.
The chorus is his clansmen, the Myrmidons.
Yes.
They tell him off for sulking in his...
Ken, yes, but can you remember an actual line that Aeschylus wrote?
Well, come into it. First, Achilles compares himself to an eagle hit by an arrow fledged with one of its own feathers. Do you know that one?
The words, the words.
Achilles is in his...
Tent!
Tent, am I telling this or are you? He's playing dice with himself. When word comes that Patroclus has been killed, Achilles goes mad, blaming him, see, for being dead. Now for the line. Does it mean nothing to you, he says, the unblemished thighs I worshipped and the showers of kisses you had from me?
Sebaste miron agnon uch epideso o viscaristeton pignon filimaton.
There you go.
Yes, I see.
No good.
Very good. It's one of the fragments that have come down to us. Also the metaphor of the eagle, but not Aeschylus' own words. Which I dare say you can't recall.
It's maddening, isn't it?
Oh, quite so. All is plain. I may as well wet the bed. The night nurse will change the sheets and tuck me up without reproach. They're very kind to me here in the Evelyn nursing home.
Houseman! Houseman!
Look alive, then. Get it!
Indeed, yes.
I've got dozens of them like that.
Oh, perhaps next time.
I'm afraid not.
Ah, yes, where is thy sting?
Picnic! Locusts! Honey!
I say, can I give you a hat?
Who is that?
Who's that? Jesus!
Thank you, dear boy.
Dead on time.
Most opportune!
Dead on time! There's no end to them.
What are you doing here, may one ask?
Classics, sir. I'm studying for grades.
Are you? Yeah, I did grades too. Of course, that was more than 50 years ago, when Oxford was still the sweet city of dreaming spires.
Oh, it must have been delightful then.
Oh, it was. I felt as if I had come up from the plains of Moab to the top of Mount Pisgah, like Moses when the Lord showed him all the land of Judah unto the utmost sea.
Well, there's a hill near our house where I live in Worcestershire, which I and my brothers and sisters call Mount Pisgah. I used to climb it often and look out towards Wales, to what I thought was a kind of promised land, though it was only the Clee Hills, really. Shropshire is our western horizon.
Oh. Excellent. You are...
Houseman, sir, of St. John's.
Well, this is an unexpected development. Where can we sit down before philosophy finds us out? I'm not as young as I was. Whereas you, of course, are.
Classical studies, eh?
Yes, sir. You are to be a rounded man, fit for the world, a man of taste and moral sense?
Yes, sir.
Science for our material improvement, classics for our inner nature, the beautiful and the good, culture, virtue, the ideas and moral influence of the ancient philosophers.
Yes, sir.
Humbug.
Oh,
looking about you. Does it appear to you that the classical fellows are the superior, in sense, morality, taste, or even amiability, to the scientists?
I'm acquainted with only one person in the science school, and he is the finest man I know.
And he knows more than the ancient philosophers.
Oh.
Well, they made the best use of the knowledge they had. They were the best minds. The French are the best cooks, and during the siege of Paris, I'm sure rats never tasted better. But that is no reason to continue eating rat now that coq au vin is available. The only reason to consider what the ancient philosophers meant about anything is if it's relevant to settling corrupt or disputed passages in the text. With the poets, there may be other reasons for reading them. I wouldn't discount it. It may even improve your inner nature. If the miraculous collusion of sound and sense in, let us say, certain poems by Horace teaches humility in regard to adding to the store of available literature poems by, let us say, yourself. But the effect is not widespread. Are these your books?
Yes, sir.
What have we here? Propertius. And Propertius. And, of course, Propertius.
Do you know him?
No, not as yet. Is he...
He's difficult. Tangled up thoughts. Or anyway, tangled up Latin.
Oh, know him.
If you can believe the manuscripts, which you can't, because they all come from the same one, and that was about as far removed from Propertius as we are from Alfred burning the cakes. He just scraped through to the invention of printing. A miracle. The first of the Roman love elegists.
And not the first, I think, strictly speaking.
Yes, really and truly. His mistress was called Cynthia. Cynthia, who first took me captive with her eyes.
Cynthia prima suis miserum me capita cellis. You mustn't forget miserum.
Yes, poor me. Well, you do know him.
Oh, yes. When I was a young man at Oxford, my edition of Propertius is going to replace all its forerunners and require no successor.
Oh, wouldn't that be something? I have been thinking of it, too. You see, Propertius is so corrupt, it seems to me, even today, here is a poet on which the work has not been done. All those editors, each with his own Propertius, right up to Barons, hot from the press. Now, Barons should make everyone obsolete. But one has hardly settled down with Barons before one is jolted out of one's chair by something like Cunctas in 115.
Oh, Cunctas is intolerable.
Exactly.
It is a man who, to defend the credit of a scribe, will impute any idiocy to a poet. His conjectures are despicable, trifling, or barbarous deprivations. Yet on the whole, his vanity and arrogance have deprived Barons of the esteem his Propertius is due.
Oh, so is he good or bad?
On that you'd have to ask his mother. And here is Paley with Et for Out in 1125. He overestimates Propertius as a poet, in my opinion, yet has no scruple in making Propertius pray that Cynthia may love him and also that he may cease to love Cynthia. Some of it may be read without mirth or disgust.
Paley!
And Palmer. Now, Palmer is a different case. He's more singularly and eminently gifted by nature than any English Latinist since Markland.
Really? Palmer, then?
With all his genius in precision of thought and stability of judgment, many excel him.
Oh.
Munro, most of all.
Oh, yes, Munro.
Munro. You wouldn't rely on for settling a text.
Oh, so really, Munro?
Oh, yes, a liar and a slave. Oh, and him. Because I could teach a dog to edit Propertius like him. And, oh, dear. Now, his idea of editing a text is to change a letter or two and see what happens. And if what happens can, by the warmest goodwill, be mistaken for sense and grammar, he calls it an emendation. This is not scholarship. It is not even a sport, like hopscotch or marbles, which requires a degree of skill. It is simply a pastime. Like leaning against a wall and spitting.
But that's Mr. Ellis. I went to him for Propertius.
Indeed, yes, I saw him. I thought he looked well. Dangerously well. Ah, Müller, and Haupt, and Rosberg. Oh, really? There's no need for you to read anything published in Germany in the last 50 years. Or the next 50.
Oh, that's only...
Ah, of course. You do write poetry.
Well, I've written poems, as one does, you know.
One does?
For the poetry prize at school. They weren't bad, I think.
Well, good for you. Mine were.
Actually, I was thinking of going in for the Newdigate. I thought the poem that won it last year was not so... How may one put it?
Not such a poem as to suggest that your attempt would be a piece of impudence.
But I don't know. I don't feel enough of a swell to carry off the Newdigate. Oscar Wilde of Magdalen, who came and went with the Newdigate and the first in greats, used to have tea with Ruskin. Pater used to have tea with him in his rooms, and talk of lilies, perhaps, and Michelangelo and the French novel. How am I to leave my mark? A monument more lasting than bronze, as Horace boasted, higher than the pyramids of kings, unyielding to wind and weather and the passage of time.
Do you mean as a poet or a scholar?
I don't mind.
I think it helps to mind.
Well, can't one be both?
No, not of the first rank. Poetical feelings are a peril to scholarship. There are always poetical people ready to protest that a corrupt line is exquisite. Exquisite to whom? The Romans were foreigners, writing for foreigners 2 millenniums ago. And for people whose gods we find quaint, whose savagery we abominate, whose private habits we don't like to talk about, but whose idea of what is exquisite is, we flatter ourselves, mysteriously identical to ours.
But it is, isn't it? We catch our breath at the places where the breath was always caught. The poet writes to his mistress how she's killed his love, fallen like a flower at the field's edge, where the plough touched it and passed on by. 2,000 years in the tick of a clock. Oh, forgive me.
You know, we're never too old to learn.
I could weep when I think how nearly lost it was, that flower, lying among the rubbish, under a wine vat, the last corrupt copy of Catullus left alive in the wreck of ancient literature. It's a cry that cannot be ignored. Do you know Monroe?
I corresponded with him once.
I'm going to write to him.
Oh.
Do you think he'd send me his photograph?
No. What a strange thing is a young man. You had better be a poet. Literary enthusiasm never made a scholar, and unmade many. Taste is not knowledge. A scholar's business is to add to what is known. That is all. But it is capable of giving the very greatest satisfaction, because knowledge is good. It does not have to look good, or sound good, or even do good. It is good just by being knowledge. And the only thing that makes it knowledge is that it is true. You can't have too much of it, and there is no little too little to be worth having. There is truth and falsehood in a comma. In your text to the marriage of Peleus and Thetis, Catullus says that Peleus is the protector of the power of Emathia. Emathiae tutamen opis, comma. Carissime nato. Now, how can Peleus be carissime nato, most dear to his son, when his son has not yet been born?
I don't know.
To be a scholar is to strike your finger on the page and say, thou ailest here and here.
The comma has got itself into the wrong place, hasn't it? Because there aren't any commas in the Oxoniensis any more than there are capital letters, which is the other thing.
Not now, nurse. Let him finish.
So opis isn't power with a small o. It's the genitive of ops, who was the mother of Jupiter. Everything comes clear when you put the comma back one place.
Emathia tutamen, comma, opis with a capital O, carissime nato, protector of Emathia, most dear to the son of ops.
Is that right?
Oh, yes, it's right, because it's true. Peleus, the protector of Emathia, was most dear to Jupiter, the son of ops. By taking out a comma and putting it back in a different place, sense is made out of nonsense in a poem that has been read continuously since it was first misprinted 400 years ago. A small victory over ignorance and error, a scrap of knowledge to add to our stock. What does this remind you of?
science, of course. Textual criticism is a science whose subject is literature, just as botany is the science of flowers and zoology of animals and geology of rocks. Of flowers, animals and rocks being the work of nature, their sciences are exact sciences and must answer to the authority of what can be seen and measured. Literature, however, being the work of the human mind with all its frailty and aberration and of human fingers which make mistakes, the science of textual criticism must aim for degrees of likelihood. And the only authority to which you might answer is an author who has been dead for hundreds or thousands of years, but it is a science, nonetheless, not a sacred mystery. Reason and common sense, a congenial intimacy with the author, a comprehensive familiarity with the language, a knowledge of ancient scripts for those fallible fingers, concentration, integrity, mother wit, repression of self-will, these are a good start for the textual critic. In other words, almost anybody can be a botanist or a zoologist. Textual criticism is the crown and summit of scholarship. Most people, though not enough, find it dry and dull. But it is the only reason for existence for a Latin professor. I tell you this because you would not know it from the way it is conducted in the English universities. The fudge and flim-flam, the hocus-pocus and plain dishonesty that parade a scholarship in the journals would excite the professional admiration of a hawker of patent medicines. In the German universities, the situation is different. Most German scholars I would put up for the Institute of Mechanics, the remainder the Institute of Statisticians. Except for Wilamowitz, who is the greatest European scholar since Richard Bentley. There are people who say that I am, but they would not know it if I were. Wilamowitz, I should add, is dead. Or will be. Or will have been dead. I think it must be time for my tablet. It orders my tenses. The future perfect, I have always regarded as an oxymoron. I wouldn't worry so much about your monument if I were you. If I had my time again, I would pay more regard to those poems of Horace which tell you will not have your time again. Life is brief. Death kicks at the door impartially. Who knows how many tomorrows the gods will grant us. Now is the time, when you are young, to deck your hair with myrtle, drink the best of the wine, pluck the fruit. Seasons and moons renew themselves. But when we go to join Aeneas, we are dust and dreams. Neither noble name, nor eloquence know, nor righteous deeds will restore us. Night holds Hippolytus the pure of stain. Diana steads him nothing, he must stay. And Theseus leaves Pirithous in the chain the love of comrades cannot take away.
What is that?
A lapse.
Oh. It's Diffugere Nives. Nec lethaio wallet Theseus abrumperi caro vincula perithoo. And Theseus has not the strength to break the Lethean bonds of his beloved Perithous.
Your translation is closer.
Were they comrades, Theseus and Pirithous?
Companions in adventure.
Oh, companions in adventure. Now, there is something to stir the soul. Was there ever a love like the love of comrades ready to lay down their lives for each other?
Oh, dear.
Oh, I don't mean spooniness, you know.
Oh, not the love of comrades that gets you sacked at Oxford.
No.
Not as in the lyric poet, when thou art kind, I spend the day like a god. When my face is turned aside, it is very dark with me.
No, I mean friendship, virtue, like the Greek heroes.
Oh, heroes, of course.
The Argonauts, Achilles and Patroclus.
Oh, Achilles would get his blue for single combat. Jason and the Argonauts would make an impression on 8th week.
Oh, is it something to be made fun of, then?
No. No.
Oh, I know very well there are things not spoken of foursquare at Oxford. The passion for truth is the faintest of all human passions here. In the translation of Tibullus in my college library, the he, loved by the poet, is turned into a she,
And then, when you come to the bit where this she goes off with somebody's wife, the translator is equal to the crisis. He leaves it out. Horace must have been a god when he wrote Diffulgere Niwes. The snows fled, and the seasons rolling round each year. But for us, when we've had our turn, it's over. You can't order words in English to get near it. Then turn a few pages back, and Horace is in tears over some athlete running after him in his dreams across the field of Mars and into the rolling waves of the Tiber. Horace, who has lots of girls in his poems, that's tame compared to Catullus. He's madly in love with Lesbia, and in between, well, the least of it, is stealing kisses from, frankly, a boy who'd still be in the junior dorm at Bromsgrove.
Catullus 99. Wester for tours is the point of interest.
No, it isn't. I'm sorry. The point of interest is, what is virtue? What is the beautiful and the good, really and truly?
You think there is an answer? The lost autograph copy of life's meaning, which we might recover from the corruptions which have made it nonsense. But if there is no such copy, really and truly, there is no answer. It's all in the timing. In Homer, Achilles and Patroclus were comrades brave and pure of stain. Centuries later, in a play now lost, Aeschylus brought in Eros, which I suppose we may translate to the extreme spooniness, showers of kisses and unblemished thighs. Sophocles, too, he wrote The Loves of Achilles. More spooniness than you'd find in a cutlery drawer, I shouldn't wonder. Also lost.
And how is it known if the plays were lost?
They were mentioned by critics.
They were critics?
Well, naturally, it was the cradle of democracy. Euripides wrote a Pirithous, the last copy having passed through the intestines of an unknown rat probably 1,000 years ago, if it wasn't burnt by bishops. The church's idea of the good and the beautiful excludes sexual aberration, apart from chastity. I suppose because it's the rarest. What is this?
It's a laurel wreath. It's actually mine.
You'd better take it then. To be the fastest runner, the strongest wrestler, the best at throwing the javelin. This was virtue when Horace in his dreams ran after Ligurinus across the field of Mars, and Ligurinus didn't lose his virtue by being caught. Virtue was practical. The athletic field was named after the god of war. If only an army should be made up of lovers and their loves. That's not me, that's Plato, or rather Phaedrus, in the Master of Balliol's nimble translation. Although a mere handful, they would overcome the world. For each would rather die 1,000 deaths than be seen by his beloved to abandon his post or throw away his arms. The veriest coward would be inspired by love. Oh, one can sneer at the sophistry of dirty old men ogling beautiful young ones. Then, as now, ideals become debased. But there was such an army. 150 pairs of lovers, the sacred band of Theban youths. And they were never beaten till Greek liberty died for good at the Battle of Chaeronea. At the end of that day, says Plutarch, the victorious Philip of Macedon went forth to view the slain. And coming to that place where the 300 fought and lay dead together, he wondered, and understanding that it was the band of lovers, he shed tears and said, whoever suspects baseness in anything these men did, let him perish.
I would be such a friend to someone.
To dream of taking the sword in the breast, the bullet in the brain.
I would.
And wake up to find the world goes wretchedly on and you will die of age and not of pain.
Well,
but lay down your life for your comrade. Good lad. Lay it down like a doormat.
Oh,
lay it down like a card on a card table for a kind word and a smile. Lay it down like a bottle of the best to drink when your damn fool life is all but done. Any more laying downs we can think of? Oh, above all, lay down your life like a pack on the roadside, though your days of march are numbered and end with the grave. Love will not be deflected from this mischief by being called comradeship or anything else.
I don't know what love is.
Oh, but you do. In the Dark Ages, in Macedonia, in the last guttering light from classical antiquity, a man copied out bits from old books for his young son, whose name was Septimius. So we have one sentence from the Lovers of Achilles. Love, said Sophocles, feels like the ice held in the hand by children. A piece of ice held fast in the fist. I wish I could help you, but it's not in my gift.
Love, it is then, and I will make the best of it. I'm sorry it has made you unhappy, but it's not my fault, and it can't be made good by unhappiness in another. Will you shake hands?
Gladly.
What happened to Theseus and Pirithous in the end?
Well, that was the end. Their last adventure was down to Hades, and they were caught, bound in invisible chains. Theseus was rescued finally, but he had to leave his friend behind. In the chain, the love of comrades cannot take away.
That's not right for a Brumperry. If it were me, I'd have put Breakaway.
If it were you, you wouldn't win the Nudigate either.
I don't suppose I will. The subject this year is from Catullus, the lament for the golden age when the gods still came down to visit us before we went to the bath.
Excellent topic for a poem. False nostalgia. Ruskin said you could see the muses dance for Apollo in Derbyshire before the railways.
Where did he say that?
There. Is there a chamber pot under this seat?
No.
Well, it probably isn't a good idea. We're always living in someone's golden age, it turns out. Even Ruskin, who takes it all so hard, hard nut. He looks hard at everything he looks at. Everything he looks at looks hard back at him. It would drive anybody mad. In no time at all, life is like a street accident, and with Ruskin raving for doctors, diverting the traffic, calling for laws to control the highway, and that's just his art criticism.
I heard Ruskin lecture in my first term. Painters belayed on every side.
Oh, I think we're in danger of going round again.
That is charmingly said. I will look at your photograph more carefully
yes,
when I get
home. Yes, we are. Painter doesn't meddle. Minds his business, steps aside. When he looks at a thing, it melts. Tone, resonance, complexity, a moment's rapture, and for him alone. Life is not there to be understood, only endured and ameliorated. You'll be all right, one way or the other. I was an absolutely safe first, too.
Didn't you get it?
No. Not a second, not a third, not even a past degree.
You were ploughed?
Yes.
But how?
That's what they all wanted to know.
What happened after that?
I became a clerk and lived in lodgings in Bayswater.
I'm sorry, they're calling me. Did you finish your prepurcious?
No.
Have you still got it?
Oh, yes. It's in a box of papers I've arranged to be burnt when I'm dead.
I'm here.
Oh,
it's time to go.
I would have died for you, but I never had the luck.
Where are we going?
Hades. I bought my Plato. Will you con him with me?
I haven't looked at it. Plato is useless to explain anything except what Plato thought.
Why study it, then?
Well, we study the ancient authors to draw lessons for our age.
Oh, that's all humbug.
Is it? Well, so it is. We study the ancient authors to get a first and a life of learned ease.
We need science to explain the world.
Jackson knows more than Plato. The only reason to consider what Plato meant about anything is if it's relevant to settling the text, which is classical scholarship. Which is a science, the science of textual criticism. Jackson, we will be scientists together. I mean, we will both be scientists. Pollard will be what passes for a classical scholar at Oxford, which is to be a literary critic in dead languages.
I say, did you see in the sketch Oscar Wilde's latest? Oh, I have worked hard all day. In the morning, I put in a comma, and in the afternoon, I took it out again.
Isn't that priceless?
Why?
What?
Oh, I see. It was a joke, you mean.
No, really, Hartman. Pull on your right, Jackson.
Do you want to take the oars?
Pocket prickle, prickle. Odes 4-1. Where were we? Oh, we're all here.
Open your Horace.
A ripple of panic like breeze across a field of wheat.
Book 4, Ode 1, A Prayer to the Goddess of Love. Intermissa venus diurosus bellamoes. Parque, preco, preco, mercy, I pray, I pray. Or perhaps better, spare me, I beg you, I beg you. The very words I spoke when I saw that Mr. Fry was determined that bella is the adjective and very likely to mean beautiful, and that as eggs go with bacon, it goes with Venus. Intermissa venus diurosus bellamoes. Beautiful Venus, having been interrupted, do you move again? He has Horace inquire in a rare moment of imbecility. And Horace is dead, as we will all be dead. But while I live, I will report his cause aright. It's war, Mr. Fry. And so is Bella. Venus, do you move? War, set in motion. War, shall we say, or start up the war. Or better, Venus, are you calling me to arms? Rursus, again, Diu, after a long time. Intermissa, having been interrupted or suspended, if you like. And what is it that has been suspended? 2 centuries ago, Bentley read Intermissa with Bella. War having been suspended, not Venus, Mr. Fry. And yes, Mr. Carson, and also Miss Frobisher. Good morning. You'll forgive us for starting without you. And now all is clear, is it not? 10 years after announcing in Book 3 that he was giving up love, the poet feels desire stirring once more and begs for mercy. Venus, are you calling me to arms again after this long time of truce? Spare me, I beg you, I beg you. And Miss Frobisher smiles. With little cause that I know of, if Jesus of Nazareth had had before him the example of Miss Frobisher getting through the Latin degree papers of the London University Examinations Board, he wouldn't have had to fall back on camels and the eyes of needles. And Miss Frobisher's name would be a delightful surprise to encounter in Matthew chapter 19. As would, even more surprisingly, the London University Examinations Board. And what? Oh, your name is not Miss Frobisher. What is your name? Miss Burton. Oh, I'm very sorry. I stand corrected. If Jesus of Nazareth had had before him the example of Miss Burton getting through the... Oh, dear. I hope it is not I who have made you cry.
I don't mind.
You don't mind? You don't mind when I make you cry? Oh, Miss Burton, you must try to mind a little. Life is in the minding. Here is Horace at the age of 50 pretending not to mind. Verse 29. Me, nec femina, nec puer. I take no pleasure in woman or boy, nor the trusting hope of love returned, nor matching drink for drink, nor binding fresh-cut flowers around my brow. But, said cor, heu ligurine cor, why, alas, ligurinus, why this unaccustomed tear trickling down my cheek? Why does my glib tongue stumble to silence as I speak? At night I hold you fast in my dreams. I run after you across the field of Mars. I follow you into the tumbling waters. And you show no pity.
All the land of Gilead unto Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah unto the utmost sea, but not including Wales, which I give to the Methodists.
But what happened, Alfred?
That's what they all wanted to know.
It's the end of fun. We're all frightened of you now. All your brothers and sisters. All except me. And I am too.
Kate.
Father feels the blow in the rain of blows. We're a house of scrimping and tiptoeing and only one fire allowed in winter. Clemence does the books to a halfpenny. Mr. Millington always said if she'd been a boy, he'd have been glad to have her in his sixth form.
And Millington thought the worst thing that could happen to me was that I'd get a second. He's asked me to take the sixth for classics from time to time, an act of charity. I'll be teaching young Basil.
I wish I'd had you to teach me. I wouldn't be the dunce. You put us all on the lawn once to be the sun and planets. I was the earth and did pirouettes round Lawrence while you skipped around me for my moonlight.
Yes.
That's all the astronomy I ever knew. Will you be a schoolmaster then?
Only while I'm waiting to take the civil service exam.
The civil service?
A servant of the crown.
Oh, like a diplomat.
Yes, exactly. Or a postman. My friend Jackson has got himself into Her Majesty's Patent Office. That would be convenient for the reading room at the British Museum. I'm going to carry on with classics. Ah, oh, look at Clee now. How blue it gets when the sun goes down.
Oh, yes. Our promised land.
I stopped believing in God, by the way.
Oh, that's just Oxford.
I was waiting by the river for my friends, Jackson and Pollard. You don't know Jackson. Pollard is the one who came to stay once. Mama disapproved of his letting us see him approach the door of the lavatory. He lacked the proper furtiveness. Well, I was waiting for them by the river, and it came upon me that I was alone, and there was no help for anything.
Mama would die if she could hear you.
I won't mention it in family prayers.
Oxford has made you smart. Do you remember what our real mother was like?
Oh, yes. And when she was ill, I sat with her all the time. We used to pray together for her to get better. And she talked to me as if I were grown up.
She can hear you.
I stopped believing in that part when I was 13.
That was only to punish him for mother dying.
And by God, he stayed punished.
Though the Philistines may jostle, you will rank as an apostle in the highest ethic band. If you walk down Piccadilly with a poppy or a lily in your medieval hand.
Wasn't it magnificent?
A landmark house.
Well, I thought it was quite jolly.
Quite jolly? It was a watershed. Doily Cars has made the theatre modern.
You mean Gilbert and Sullivan?
What? No, the theatre.
Oh, I see.
The first theatre lit entirely by electricity.
Oh, dear old Mo.
Doily Cart's New Savoy is a triumph.
You're the only London theatre critic worthy of the name. The new electrified Savoy is a triumph. The contemptible flickering gaslit St. James's.
Oh, I know you're ragging me.
The murky malodorous Haymarket. The unscientific Adelphi.
But it was exciting, wasn't it, House? Every age thinks it's the modern age, but this one really is. Electricity is going to change everything. Everything. We had an electric corset sent in today.
One that lights up.
I've never thought of it before, but in a way, the patent office is the gatekeeper to the new age.
Oh, an examiner of electrical specifications, maybe, but it's not the same with us toiling down in trademarks. I had sore throat lozenges today. An application to register a wonderfully woebegone giraffe. Raised rather a subtle point in trademarks regulation, actually. It seems there's already a giraffe at large, wearing 12 styles of celluloid collar, but, and here's the nub, a happy giraffe. In fact, a preening, self-satisfied giraffe. Well, the question arises, is the registered giraffe platonic? Are all God's giraffes in Esse et in Posse to be rendered unto the Houndsditch Novelty Collar Company?
Oh, it's true, then. A classical education fits a fella for anything.
Well, I consulted my colleague, Chamberlain. He's compiling the new index. I don't think he's altogether sound, Chamberlain. He put John the Baptist under mythological characters.
Do you know what someone said?
And a monk holding a tankard under biblical subjects.
Will you tell me what happened?
Oh, found for the lozenges.
Someone said you ploughed yourself on purpose.
Pollard.
No. But they had him in to ask about you.
Oh, I saw Pollard in the reading room.
And what did he have to say?
Nothing. It was the reading room. We adjusted our expressions briefly.
We got what we wanted. Pollard at the British Museum, and here's me with an examinership and 300 a year with prospects. You were cleverer than any of us, House.
Well, I didn't get what I wanted, that's true, but I want what I've got.
You're pushing a pen at 38 shillings a week.
But here we are, you and I. We eat the same meals in the same digs. We catch the same train to work in the same office, and the work is easy. I've got time to do classics. And friendship is all. Oh, sometimes I'm so happy, it makes me dizzy. And look, I have prospects too. I'm published. I was saving it for Coco.
I say.
The Journal of Philology. See?
Horatiana. A.E. Houseman. I say. What is it?
Well, it's putting people right about what Horace really wrote.
Horace?
The only bits. I'm working on Propertius, really.
Well done, House. We must celebrate it.
We have. That's why I...
Oh, still owe you for the thing?
No. It was my idea. Anyway, you thought the electricians were the best thing in it.
Well, the girls were pretty. And the tunes. It was only the story.
The whole thing was silly.
Jolly, you said. You don't have to agree with me all the time.
I don't.
Well, you do, you know, House. You should stick to your own opinions more. What gets my goat, actually, if you want to know, is that the fellow isn't worth the fuss. None of them are. I mean, what use is he to anyone?
Who?
These East seats, the show.
Oh.
What gets me is all this attention. You can't open a newspaper and cartoons in Punch every time he opens his mouth being aesthetic and better than ordinary people working at proper things. I mean, what's he ever done? And now, an operetta, for heaven's sake, to make him talk of the town twice over. What has he ever done? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, he's had a book of poems.
Well, I've got nothing against poetry. Don't think I have. I like a good poem as well as the next man. But you don't find Tennyson flouncing about Piccadilly trying to be witty, do you? And all that posing and dressing up, it's not manly, if you ask me, House.
It wasn't him with the electric corset, was it?
There were several at Oxford, I remember.
Do you remember he said your leg was a poem?
Which one?
Left. Wilde. Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde? Was at Oxford with us?
In our first year. He went down with the first in greats. I went to Warren, his tutor at Magdalen. You don't remember?
Well, there was a Wilde who bowled a bit. Left arm round the wicket.
No. Blue china.
Wait a minute. Velvet knickerbockers. Well, I'm damned. I knew he wasn't the full shilling.
We invented Oscar. We bodied him forth. Then we floated him. And then we kited the stock. When Doyle Carr took patients to New York, he had the idea of bringing Oscar to America and exhibiting him as the original aesthetic article for purposes of publicity. And Oscar did him proud before he was off the boat. Mr. Wilde, disappointed by Atlantic. You remember that, Sten? Huh? Yeah, you gave his space in the Gazette, and I printed the Atlantic's reply in Truth. Huh? Atlantic, disappointed by Mr. Wilde. I wrote him up nicely, and Oscar, who didn't know it was all a ramp, told people over there, Henry Labouchere's one of my heroes. It's all in all most satisfactory. A job well done. But now he's got away from us. No matter where we cut the string, the kite won't fall. The ramp is over, and the stock keeps rising. When he came home, he had the cheek to lecture in Piccadilly on his impressions of America. I filled 3 columns under the heading Exit Oscar. I dismissed him, no doubt to his surprise, as an effeminate phrase maker. Oh. I counted up the number of times he used the word beautiful, lovely, or charming. Came to 86. You think that would stick anybody? Oh, no, not at all. He went off round the provinces, and people paid good money to be told they were provincial. Their houses were ugly inside and out, their dress dowdy, their husbands dull, their wives plain, and their opinions on art worthless. Meanwhile, Oscar himself has never done anything.
You were on the wrong end of the string, Labby.
Up, up, up. It shakes one's faith in the operation of a moral universe by journalism.
As the aimless arrow brings us down, the arrow fledged with one of our own feathers.
You really ought to edit the Old Testament, old man.
He does, Frank, he does.
The Pall Mall Gazette is testament enough that the Lord is at my elbow. And was there today when I forced Parliament to pass the Criminal Law Amendment Act.
You know, Stead, most people think you're mad.
Yeah.
They thought so even before you bought a 13-year-old virgin for £5 to prove a point. A wonderful stunt, I wouldn't deny. I doffed my hat. When I took over the evening news, edited the paper with the best in me at 28. The circulation wouldn't budge. So I edited the paper as a boy of 14.
Ah.
The circulation started to rise and never looked back.
No, by heaven, Harris. In the right hands, the editor's pen is the scepter of power. For us, life can once more be brilliant, as in the heroic days. In my first campaign, when I was still a young man in the provinces, I roused the North against Lord Beaconsfield's Eastern policy. The honour of the Bulgarian virgins, I told my readers, is in the hands of the British voter. I heard the clear call of the voice of God when I forced the government to send General Gordon to Khartoum. And I heard it again in my campaign, which today has given 13, 14 and 15-year-old British virgins the protection of Parliament.
General Gordon got his head cut off.
Whether he did or not.
He did.
We journalists have a divine mission to be the tribunes of the people.
The Sudan was my blooding as a journalist. In 76, I was with General Gordon at the Battle of Kebel Ghazi.
Yeah. Well, I'm a member of Parliament. I don't have to be a journalist to be a tribune of the people. No, you weren't, Frank. You were at Brighton. The Criminal Law Amendment Act is badly drawn up and will do more harm than good, as I said in my paper. In 76, Frank, you were a French tutor at Brighton College, or so you told Hattie during the interval at Phaedra.
That was a flight of fancy.
Now, the bill should have been referred to a select committee, and would have been, but for the government being stampeded by your disgusting articles, Fred.
Traditionally, Parliament has always been the protector of the British virgin. Though, usually, on a first-come, first-served basis.
You made the Pall Mall Gazette look sensational, even when there's nothing sensational in it.
Yeah.
But the maiden tribute campaign was a disgrace to decency. Now, you had errand boys reading about filthy goings-on which concerned nobody but their sisters.
Is it true, Stead? You caught a mouse in the Gazette office and ate it on toast.
Perfectly true. When I came down from Darlington to join the Gazette,
up.
They never sold more than 13,000 copies.
Up.
Never deserved to. It kept the reader out.
Up from Darlington.
I introduced the crosshead in 81, the illustration in 82, the interview in 83, the personal note, the signed article.
Why did you eat a mouse?
I want you to know what it tasted like.
Well, you should have asked me. I ate them in Paris during the siege, and rats and cats.
I invented the new journalism.
We didn't eat the rats till we'd eaten all the cats.
I gave virtue a voice Parliament couldn't ignore.
Then we ate the dogs, and when there were no dogs left, we ate the animals in the zoo.
Item, the age of consent raised from 13 to 16.
I sent my dispatches out by balloon, and I made my name. I suppose you were in the siege of Paris too, Frank.
No, in 1870 I was building the Brooklyn Bridge.
Item. Girls in moral danger may be removed from their parents by the court.
Well, that'll be a dead letter.
It was your amendment.
Anybody with any sense on the back benches was pitchforking amendments in to get the government to admit it had a pig's breakfast on its hands and withdraw it. My amendment on indecency between male persons, God help me, it went through on the nod. It had nothing to do with the bill we're supposed to be debating, but everyone wanted to be shot in the business and get on with the general election.
Yeah, but surely you intended the bill to address a contemporary evil?
Nothing of the sort. I intended to make the bill absurd to any sensible person left in what by then was a pretty thin house, but that one got away, so now a French kiss and what you fancy between two chaps, safe at home with the door shut, is good for 2 years, with or without hard labour.
Oh, then your mischief was timely. London shows all the indications of falling into the abyss of perverse eroticism that encompassed the fall of Greece and Rome.
What indications are there?
Oh, there is the scepticism of what is morally elevating. A taste for the voluptuous and the forbidden in French literature. Now, lest these look to Paris for their sins, which I will not name, which are so odious they should never have been allowed to leave France.
Actually, in Greece and Rome, sodomy was rarely associated with a taste for French novels. It was the culture of the athletic ground and the battlefield, as in Sparta, for example, or the Sacred Band of Thebes. It so happens that I was wandering through Greece in October of 1880, travelling sometimes on foot, sometimes on horse, putting up at monasteries or with shepherds in their huts, and I arrived, finally, at Thebes. There was a German archaeologist there who said his name was Schliemann.
Harris, do you ever tell the truth?
Who told us that a young Greek lad had just discovered a very large grave at Chaeronea nearby, right under the stone lion erected by Philip of Macedon to commemorate his victory there in 338 BC. It was at the Battle of Chaeronea, you remember, where, according to Plutarch, 150 pairs of lovers pledged to defend Thebes from the invader fought and died to the last man. Well, I stayed on there until we had uncovered 297 skeletons buried together.
So it was you.
They were in two layers, packed like sardines. You could still see where the Macedonian lances smashed arms, ribs, skulls. Most extraordinary thing I've ever seen.
What do you think, Houseman? £5 for a virgin. Would that mean one go?
Well, you can't have two goes at the same virgin.
Or do you get it to keep, I mean? What are the parliamentary reports coming to?
Hang on, Chamberlain. Is that the quarter mile lining up? I can't see Jackson.
It probably isn't, Vincent.
Are you sure? We haven't come all the way out to Ealing to miss it.
Mr. Labouchere, Lib Northampton. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, that's opened up the northwest passage for every black mailer in town.
I do believe it is the quarter mile, you know. Can you see him?
The quarter mile is a flat race, isn't it? That's hurdles.
Oh, yes, it's after the 220 hurdles.
Running late.
No, no, 220 yards.
It's down, you're like a nervous girl.
No offence, old chap. I like you more than anyone I know. I even like you for the way you stick to Jackson, but he'll never want what you want. You'll have to find it somewhere else or you'll be unhappy. Even unhappier. I know whereof I speak. I don't mind you knowing. I know you won't tell on me at the office. You're the straightest, kindest man I know, and I'm sorry for you, that's all. And I'm sorry if I spoke out of turn. He'll be in the first three if he keeps it up.
What do I want?
Nothing which you call indecent. Though I don't see what's wrong with it myself. You want to be brothers in arms. To have him to yourself. To be shipwrecked together. Perform valiant deeds to earn his admiration. To save him from certain death. To die for him. To die in his arms like a Spartan. Kissed once on the lips. Or just run his errands in the meanwhile. You want him to know what cannot be spoken. And to make the perfect reply in the same language. He's going to win it. By God, he is! Come on, Jackson! Up to patent office, he's won it!
He won!
We should have brought champagne!
No, no, he likes his bottle of biblical subject.
Well, come on then. I'm thirsty with all that running.
Houseman.
Oh, well,
there you are. Was that the quarter?
Oh, Pollard, you duffer, you missed it. He won!
Damn. I mean, you know what I mean. I couldn't get here a minute sooner. I bet I ran faster from the station than Jackson. Well, how do you do?
Chamberlain, this is Pollard. Pollard, this is Chamberlain.
I'm very pleased to meet you.
He's at the British Museum.
Not an exhibit. I work in the library.
Well, you are an exhibit.
Here, look.
There. We've got a picnic.
Ah, locusts and honey.
Three of us used to take a boat down to Hades with a picnic.
Where's Mo?
It was only once.
We were chums together at St. John's.
Hades?
Oh, Chamberlain is an expert on the Baptist, that well-known mythological character.
Really?
It was a water biscuit. Yes, it's confusing. But we keep an open mind at the trademarks registry.
Oh, here he is.
Victor Ludorum.
Ave Ligurine.
Well done, Mo.
I say, what was your time?
Oh, I don't know. It's only a race, don't make a fuss. 54, apparently. Hello, Pollard. Thanks. This is sporting of you. And sandwiches.
Age before beauty.
I'll get changed first. Oh, got the pink one. Good man. How are the Australians doing?
At what?
Oh, really, Pollard?
So the paper is full of white slave traffic today. Apparently we lead the world in exporting young women to Belgium.
It's disgusting the way the papers have been hashing it up.
Hushing it up?
Not hushing, hashing. Yes. Well, we'll never know.
It's nothing much to know anyway. Before books were printed, often you'd have one person dictating to two or three copies.
But then hundreds of years later, there'd be a manuscript in one place that's got hushing it up, and one in another place that's got hashing it up.
And in Latin, of course, and people like Houseman here arguing about which the author really wrote. Yes. Well, have you got something in there, the journal?
No.
Why?
No.
Well, then, of course, the copies get copied, so you can argue about which copy came first and which scribes had bad habits. Oh, the fun is endless.
But there's no way to tell if they both make sense.
One of them always makes the better sense, if you can get into the writer's mind without prejudices.
Toss the coin. I would.
That's another good method. We're only teasing, Houseman. Don't look so down in the mouth.
No, I'm off. Apologise for Mr. Jackson. I've got to meet someone in the West End at 5.
Well, there's still plenty of trains.
I came on my bicycle.
Goodness.
It was very nice to meet you.
Well, likewise. Yes, don't keep the lady waiting.
You've guessed my secret. Thanks, Houseman.
I'm sorry you have to go. Thank you.
Wouldn't have missed it.
Nor I.
But you did.
Oh. That.
I'll see you on Monday.
No need to tell Jackson. He'd be disappointed. Why did you call him Ligurinus?
Wasn't it Ligurinus?
running across the campus marshes.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for letting me see this.
What did you think?
Well, you won't expect me to judge it. I'm no propertious scholar.
Well, no, but you've read him.
Hardly. I read a few of the elegies in my third year, but propertius is too rough-cornered for my taste.
Yes, mine too. Oh, no. To be a scholar, the first thing you have to learn is that scholarship is nothing to do with taste. Speaking, of course, as a hired division clerk in Her Majesty's Patent Office. You know, Propertius looked to me like a garden gone to wilderness. Not a very interesting garden either, but what an opportunity. It was begging to be put back in order. Better still, various nincompoops thought they'd already done it, hacking about to make room for their dandelions. So far, I've improved the Vulgate in about 200 places. But I have.
I'm sure you have.
Well, what worries you about it?
Well, the tone of some of it. It's a bit breathtaking. Oh, it's all right me reading it. I know what a soft old thing you are underneath. But it's not the way scholars generally deal with each other, is it?
No, Bentley and Scaliger, you were far ruder.
But that was centuries ago, and you're not Bentley. Not yet. Anyway, who is Postgate?
He's a good man. One of the best of the younger Propertius critics. He's a professor at UCL.
Well, makes nonsense of the whole elegy from beginning to end.
Well, he does. Woke as in verse 33, isn't he? Mendation to frighten children in their beds.
But I imagine these considerations will have occurred to Mr. Postgate himself ere now, or will have been pointed out to him by his friends. But it's so disrespectful.
Oh. Your point being that I'm a clerk in the patent office.
No, I'm not saying that.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Oh, let's not fall out. Have another biblical subject.
I was only thinking, suppose you apply for a lectureship at University College and your Mr. Postgate was on the selection committee.
I'd only apply for a chair at UCL.
Oh, Houseman, what will become of you?
You're my only friend who might understand. Don't let me down. If I'm disrespectful, it's because it's important. Not a game anyone can play. I could have given Chamberlain a proper answer. Scholarship doesn't need to wriggle out of it with a joke. It's where we're nearest to our humanness. Useless knowledge for its own sake. No, useful knowledge is good too, but it's for the faint-hearted. An elaboration of the real thing, which is only to shine some light. Doesn't matter where, on what, it's the light itself against the darkness. It's what's left of God's purpose when you take away God. Doesn't mean I don't care about the poetry. I do. Disulgere nives goes through me like a spear. Nobody makes it stick like Horace that you're a long time dead, dust and shadow. And no good deeds, no eloquence will bring you back. I think it's the most beautiful poem in Latin or Greek there ever was. But in verse 15, Horace never wrote dives, which is in all the texts. And I'm pretty sure I know what he did write. Anyone who says so what got left behind 500 years ago when we became modern. That's why it's called humanism. The recovery of ancient texts is the highest task of all. Oh, Erasmus, bless him. It is work to be done. Posterity has a brisk way with manuscripts. Scholarship is a small redress against the vast unreason of what is taken from us. It isn't just the worthless that perish. Jesus doesn't save.
Stop it, Houseman. The sun is shining. It's Saturday afternoon.
I'm happy.
The best survives because it is the best. Oh, Pollard.
Have you ever seen a cornfield after the reaping? Laid flat to stubble, and here and there, unaccountably, miraculously spared, a few stalks still upright. Why those? There is no reason. Ovid's Medea, the Thyestes of Varius, who was Virgil's friend and considered by some his equal, the lost Aeschylus trilogy of the Trojan War gathered to oblivion in sheaves, along with hundreds of Greek and Roman authors known only for fragments or their names alone.
here and there. A cornstalk, a thistle, a poppy. Still standing. But as to purpose, signifying nothing.
I know what you want.
What do I want?
A monument. Houseman was here.
Oh, you've guessed my secret.
A mud pie against the incoming tide.
Oh, a fine way to talk about my edition of Propertius.
Oh, here's to you and your Propertius.
Who's that with Jackson? Do you know her?
No.
Yes, she came to the office.
Don't stare.
I'm not.
Well, coupled with the British Museum Library, the aggregate of all human progress made stackable.
Making a stand against the natural and merciful extinction of the unreadable. How very British of it. Bring back the manuscript. Is it over? People seem to be leaving. When you consider the ocean of bills brought forth by the invention of printing, it does make you wonder about this boon of civilization. I wonder about it every time I open the Journal of Philology. No? They're gathering.
Oh.
They're giving out the trophy. Well, come on!
Blessed as one of the gods is he, the youth who fondly sits by thee, and hears and sees thee all the while, softly speak and sweetly smile. For while I gaze with trembling heart...
Coco?
Thanks. Did you write this?
Well, Sappho, really, more or less.
What's that one you used to have about kisses?
The Catullus. Give me 1,000 kisses, then 100 more.
Yes. She might think that's a bit hot, though. It should really be about me being unhappy and ticking her off for her unfaithfulness, and at the same time willing to forgive. Where's the one again where I'm carving her name on trees?
Oh, Propertius, but honestly, that's a bit raving. She's only said she's staying in to wash her hair.
But I've got tickets and everything, after being at her beck and call.
Quinquet tibi potuis servere fideliter annu... 5 years, your faithful slave.
Exactly. 2 weeks, anyway.
The problem we're up against here is that the ticking-off ones make her out to be a harlot, and the happy ones make her out to be, well, your harlot. So I think the way to go is more carpe diem. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace.
She'd never believe I wrote that.
Oh, dear old Mo, what will become of you?
Orchestra stalls, too.
Oh, well, if that's the price for kisses due, that's the last kiss I steal from you. Written to a boy, but never mind. Interesting poem, by the way, Westerford Tours.
She thinks you're sweet on me.
Plural for singular, first you... What?
Rosa said you're sweet on me.
What did she mean?
Well, you know.
What did you say?
I said it was nonsense. We're chums. We've been chums since Oxford, you, me and Pollard.
Did she think Pollard was sweet on you?
She didn't talk about Pollard. You're not, are you, House?
You're my best friend.
Well, that's what I said, like...
Theseus and Pirithous.
The Three Musketeers.
What did she say?
Well, she hasn't read it.
Well, I don't understand. You mean just from Saturday, from going home together on the train, from Ealing?
I suppose so, yes. It was odd Chamberlain being there that day.
Why?
Well, it was just odd. An odd coincidence. I was going to mention it.
Mention what?
Mention that perhaps you shouldn't get to be pals with him too much. It may be misunderstood.
You think Chamberlain is sweet on me?
No, of course not. But one has heard things about Chamberlain at the office. I'm sorry now I mentioned him. I know I'm all hobnails, but you're all right about it, aren't you, House? You see, I'm awfully strong on Rosa. She's not like other girls. She's not what I'd call a girl at all. You saw that for yourself. She's a woman. We love each other.
I'm glad for you, Mo. I liked her very much.
Did you? I knew you would. You're a good pal to me, and I hope I am to you. I knew I'd only have to ask, and that'd be the end of it. I'll tell her she's a cuckoo. Shake hands?
Gladly.
Still pals?
And comrades.
Like whoever they were?
Theseus and Pirithous. They were kings. They met on the field of battle to fight to the death, but... when they saw each other, each was struck in admiration for his adversary. So they became comrades instead and had many adventures together. Theseus was never so happy as when he was with his friend. They weren't sweet on each other. loved each other. As men loved each other in the heroic age, in virtue, paired together in legend and poetry as the pattern of comradeship, the chivalric ideal of virtue in the ancient world. Virtue. What happened to it? Oh, it had a good run, centuries. It was still virtue in Socrates to admire a beautiful youth, virtue to be beautiful and admired. It was still there, grubbier and a shadow of itself, but still there for my Roman poets who competed for women and boys as fancy took them. Virtue in Horace to shed tears of love over Ligurinus on the athletic field. Well, not any more, Amo. Virtue is what women have to lose. The rest is vice. Pollard thinks I'm sweet on you too, though he hardly knows he thinks it. Will you mind if I go to live somewhere but close by?
Why? Oh.
We'll still be friends. Won't we?
Oh.
Of course, Rosa knew. And of course she'd know.
Oh.
Did you really not know? Not even for a minute?
How could I know? You seem just like, you know, normal. You're not one of those aesthete types or anything. How could I know?
You mean if I dressed like the Three Musketeers, you'd have suspected. You're half my life. We took a picnic down to Hades. There was a dog on the island there, friendly, lost dog, not even wet, mystery. He jumped into the boat to be rescued. Do you remember the dog? Pollard and I were arguing about English or Latin being best for poetry. The dog was subjoined. Lost dog loves young man, dog lost young man loves, loves lost young man, dog you can't beat Latin. Shuffle the words to suit, the endings tell you which loves what, who's young, who's lost. If you can't read Latin, go home, you've missed it. You kissed the dog. After that day, everything else seemed futile and ridiculous. The ridiculous idea that one's life was poised on the reading course. Dog.
Dog. If only you hadn't said anything, we could have carried on the same.
It's not your fault. That's what I say. It's terrible, but it's not your fault. You won't find me casting the first stone. We'll be just like before.
Do you mean it, Mo?
No one will hear it from me. We've been pals a long time.
Thank you.
It's rotten luck, but it'll be our secret. You'll easily find some decent digs around here. We'll catch the same train to work as always, and I bet before you know it, you'll meet the right girl and all three be chuckling over this. Rosa, I mean. So, what about that? I dare say I've surprised you. All right. Shake on it.
He would not stay for me. And who can wonder? He would not stay for me to stand and gaze. I shook his hand and tore my heart in sunder and went with half my life about my ways.
Am I asleep or awake? We arrive at evening upon a field of battle where lie 200 corpses. 197 of them have no beards. The 198th has a beard on the chin. The 199th has a false beard slewed round under the left ear. The 200th has been decapitated and the head is nowhere to be found. Problem. Had it a beard, a false beard, or no beard at all?
Mr. Bukola can tell you. It had a beard on the chin. I only say look at the logic. Because a manuscript has suffered loss, therefore the lost portion contains something that Mr. Bukola wishes it to have contained, and scholars have been unable to detect any error in his reasoning.
During the last 10 years, the study of the classics has been the chief occupation of my leisure.
But I have long dwelt among men.
Copies of Mr. Houseman's testimonials for the professorship here at UCL are tabled.
Conjectures, to Mr. Marx's eyes, are arranged in a threefold order of merit. First, the conjectures of Mr. Marx. Second, the conjectures of mankind in general. Third, the conjectures of certain odious persons.
A post office clerk?
Patent office. Supported by the professors of Latin at Oxford and Cambridge, of Latin and Greek at Dublin, the editor of the Classical Review, Warren, the president of Magdalen.
The width and variety of Franklin's ignorance are wonderful. For stupidity of plan and slovenliness of execution, his apparatus criticus is worse than Brighter's apparatus to Manilius, and I never saw another of which that could be said.
Is he well-liked, Professor Postgate?
Confronted with two manuscripts of equal merit, he is like a donkey between two bundles of hay, and confusedly imagines that if one bundle were removed, he would cease to be a donkey.
He is well remarked.
The nodes are vicious to a degree which well nigh protects them from refutation, so intricate is the tangle of every imaginable kind of blunder. And his main purpose in withholding useful information is to make room for a long record of conjectures which dishonour the human intellect.
When Mr. Houseman took my sixth form, he proved himself a thorough and sympathetic teacher.
Having small literary culture, he is not revolted by illiteracy or dismayed by the hideous, and has a relish for the uncouth, yet would defend Pronos against Bentley's Prevost as being very poetical. Although Bentley never denied it was poetical, he only denied it was Latin.
The sagacity and closeness desiderated by Bentley, Warren, one of the most interesting and attractive pupils I can remember.
And Robinson Ellis of Trinity. Personally, I have always found Mr. Houseman an amiable and modest man.
No word is safe from Mr. Robinson Ellis, if he can think of a similar one which is not much worse. Trying to follow his thoughts is like being in perpetual contact with an idiot child.
Well, Professor Postgate.
But Mr. Postgate's morbid alertness is cast into deep sleep at Modo in verse 11, and it's good night, grammatical science.
Yes, what do you say, Postgate?
Of Mr. Postgate's Voces from Noctes in 33... I am at a loss to know what to say.
I have to declare an interest.
The alteration makes nonsense of the whole elegy from beginning to end.
Mr. Houseman is applying for this post at my urging. He is, in my view, very likely the best classical scholar in England. Though he is not always right on proportion.
Here you are.
Tempus fugit. Nunc est vivendo.
Carpe diem.
Exeunt omnes.
And I, with some thought and some pains, have got this rather uninteresting garden into decent order. Here is Dr. Postgate hacking at the fence in a spirited attempt to re-establish chaos amongst Propertius manuscripts. All the tools he employs are two-edged, though to be sure both edges are blunt. I feel it a hardship, but I suppose it is a duty to...
Your stemma codicum is fundamentally flawed. Not to mince words, it is almost totally wrong. Your reliance on Behrens's dating of the Neapolitanus was a blunder.
You've seen the paper.
I'm in the act of replying to it. I intend to make you ashamed.
The paper.
Oh.
Oscar Wilde has been arrested.
Oh.
I had no idea I had offended you, Postgate.
Guilty. Sentenced to 2 years with hard labour.
Now, the ascetic cult in its nasty form is now over. Open the windows. Let in the fresh air. By our dramatic critic. Convicted under the Labouchere Amendment Clause.
Oh, who is that young sinner with the handcuffs on his wrists? And what has he been after? That they groan and shake their fists.
And wherefore is he wearing such a conscience-stricken air? Oh, they're taking him to prison. For the colour of his hair.
I begged him to leave the country. I had a closed cab waiting at Hyde Park Corner and a steam yacht at Gravesend.
No, you didn't, Frank. You told him to brazen it out at the Café Royal. 2 years is totally inadequate. I wanted a maximum of 7 years.
With a lobster supper on board and a bottle of Pommery.
Oh, look, it wasn't a yacht. It was a table at the Café Royal. The Attorney General of the day persuaded me that 2 years was more likely to secure a conviction from a hesitant jury.
You did it to scupper the bill. That's what you told me.
Yeah, who's going to believe you?
If Oscar Wilde's tastes had been for fresh, young, innocent virgins of, say, 16, no one would have laid a finger on him.
I did it because Stead happened to tell me just before the debate that in certain parts of London, the problem of indecency between men was as serious as with virgins.
Mm. There's no serious problem with virgins in certain parts of London.
With virgins, there are tastes. In certain parts. Best left to a learned tongue.
My point.
Hmm? Now it is oakum for his fingers, and the treadmill for his feet, and the quarry gang on Portland in the cold and in the heat. And between his spells of labor in the time he has to spare, he can curse the god that made him for the colour of his hair.
Pull on your right, Jerome K.
Do you want to take the oars?
No, you're doing splendidly.
Shut up, Chamberlain.
Anybody hungry?
Harris hasn't done any work since we left Henley.
When Chamberlain said take a boat up the river, I understood him to mean a boat which takes passengers from one place to another, not an arrangement where the passengers take the boat. Personally, I...
Shut up, Harris.
Where are we, Jay?
Getting towards Reading.
Reading? Will we pass the jail?
Perhaps Oscar will see us going by. He always asked for the river view at the Savoy.
The prostitutes danced in the streets.
So did Jay.
I did not. It's true that as the editor of a popular newspaper, I had a duty to speak out. But I take no pride in the fact that it was I, as much as anybody, I suppose, who was indirectly responsible for the tragic unfolding of...
Shut up, Jay!
I'm not sorry. I might have been sorry if he'd kept his misfortune to himself, like a gentleman.
Posing as a gentleman.
Exactly. And his work won't last either. Decadence was a blind alley in English life and letters. Wholesome humour has always been our strength. Wholesome humour and a rattling good yarn. Look at Shakespeare.
Robbie Ross gave me this man's poems. He got several off by heart to tell them to Oscar when he went to see him in prison.
Oh, yes. Goss said to me, who's this houseboat person Robbie likes?
Not houseboat. A.E. Houseman.
Alfred Houseman.
I think he stayed with the wrong people in Shropshire. I never read such a book for telling you you're better off dead.
That's him.
No one gets off. If you're not shot, hanged, or stabbed, you kill yourself. Life's a curse, love's a blight, God's a blackguard. Cherry Blossom is quite nice.
He's a Latin prof.
But of the Greek persuasion, would you say, eh, George?
3 or 4 years ago, he was just one of us in the patent office.
Uranian persuasion, I mean.
How can one tell?
I could. Is there something eye-catching about the way he dresses?
As opposed to George, you mean?
That's the point, eh, George?
Pull the other one, Jay.
Do you want to take the oars? The thoughts of others were light and fleeting, of lovers meeting, or luck or fame. Mine were of trouble, and mine were steady,
So I was ready when trouble came.
Pull the other one.
Chamberlain, I haven't thought about you for years. You've got a moustache.
Hello, old chap. Yet I'm not sure about it. But it's growing on me.
Oh, I see. That's a good one.
I see you living to a ripe old age. I wouldn't have put a tanner on it the way you looked.
When?
Most of the time. Happy days, I don't think. When Jackson went off to be a headmaster in India. No, worse before. No, worse after, when he came home on leave to be married. No, before. That time no one could find you for a week. Well, I thought the river and no two ways about it. But you turned up again. Dry as a steak. And I did tell you, didn't I?
Tell me what? Oh. Yes, you did tell me.
Still, you probably wouldn't have written the poems.
This is true.
Certain ill wind from yon far country blows through Holton Hanger.
If I might give you a piece of advice, Chamberlain, mangling a chap's poems isn't the way to show you've read them.
I'm word perfect. Oh, were he and I together. Shipmates on the fleeted main, sailing through the summer weather. What happened to Jackson?
He retired. Settled in British Columbia. Died of cancer.
Well, early though the laurel grows, it withers quicker than the rose.
This is a revolting habit, Chamberlain. I forbid you.
Oh, I like them. I really do. Halt and hanger. Cumber. Fuse. Lovely old words. Never knew what they meant. But proper poetry, no question about that. You old slyboot. You must have been writing poetry all the time you were in trademarks.
Not so much. It was a couple of years after something overcame me at the beginning of 95. A ferment. I wrote half the book in the first 5 months of that year before I started to calm down. It was a time of strange excitement.
The Oscar Wilde trials.
Oh, really, Chamberlain? You should take up biography.
Yes. What about those ploughboys and village lads dropping like flies all over Shropshire? Those that didn't take the Queen's shilling and get shot in foreign parts.
The landscape of the imagination.
Even the ones you didn't put in the book. Because I liked you better than suits a man to stay. But this unlucky love should last when answered passions thin to air.
Could you contain yourself?
Did you send them to Jackson?
No.
Saving them? Till you're dead?
It's a courtesy. Confession is an act of violence against the unoffending. Can you see the bonfires? It's the old Queen's Diamond Jubilee. I was a Victorian poet, don't forget.
From sea to heaven, the beacon burns.
It was a grand sight. I counted 52 fires just to the south and west. Malvern had the biggest, but it burned out in an hour.
The Clent fire is a good one. The boys are here.
Do I know them?
Your nephews, Alfred.
Oh, your boys. Well, of course I know them.
And the Millingtons. Mrs. M says you're no guide to Shropshire. She went to look at Hewley Church and it doesn't even have a steeple. Never mind a graveyard full of suicides.
Well, that can surely be rectified. I never expected a 2 and 6 penny book which couldn't sell out an edition of 500 copies to draw pilgrims to Hewley. I was never there. I just liked the name.
Lawrence thought he was the poet in the family. Now he knows your book by heart and recites his favourites. He met someone who told him a Shropshire lad was his best yet.
I hope no one is attributing his poems to me.
It's sweet of him to be proud.
It is, yes.
We're all proud. And astonished. Clem said Alfred has a heart.
No, not at all. I was depressed because of a sore throat which wouldn't leave me. Might have gone on writing poems for years, but luckily I remembered a brand of lozenges and was cured.
A sore throat?
Punishment for a disagreeable controversy in the journals. You were clever to be a dunce, Kate, before it found you out.
Oh, listen. The larks think it's daybreak.
Or the end of the world.
Oh, you. Same old Alfred.
But I intend to change. And the day nurse will get the benefit of my transformation into a character. The Wag of the Evelyn. I have been practicing a popular style of lecture, as yet confused with memories of university college, but it's based on noticing that there are students present. I shall cause a sensation by addressing a remark to my neighbour at dinner in hall.
I am trying to think of a remark. My reputation at Trinity is for censoriousness and misanthropy. Well, some people say it's only shyness. Impudent fools. Nevertheless, I am determined. Affability is only suffering the fools gladly. And Cambridge affords endless scope for this peculiar joy. I introduced creme brulee to Trinity. But if that isn't enough, I'll talk to people. Do you still ride a bicycle?
Yes, a Robertson. I know your brother, Lawrence. We belong to a sort of secret society, the Order of Chironea, like the Sacred Band of Thieves. Actually, it's more like a discussion group. We discuss what we should call ourselves. Homosexuals has been suggested.
Homosexuals?
No, we aren't anything till there's a word for it.
Homosexuals. Who is responsible for this barbarity?
What's wrong with it?
It's half Greek and half Latin.
Sounds about right. What happened to me, by the way?
Oh, how should I know? I suppose you became a sort of footnote.
Listen. Oh, the Marseillaise. That's unusual, isn't it? For the Queen's Jubilee.
Oscar Wilde was in France, on the coast near Dieppe. I'd sent him my book when he came out of prison.
Shot. So quick, so clean an ending. Oh, that was right, lad, that was brave. Yours was not an ill for mending, 'twas best to take it to the grave. This was not one of the ones Robbie learned for me, but your poems, when I opened your parcel, were not all strangers. Oh, you had forethought, you could reason, and saw your road and where it led, and early wise and brave in season.
I beg you, Mr. Wilde, to me they're importunate friends when they take the floor.
And early wise and brave in season, put the pistol to your head. Oh, poor silly boy.
I read the report of the inquest in the Evening Standard.
Oh, thank goodness. That explains why I never believed a word of it.
But it's all true.
On the contrary, it's only fact. Truth is quite another thing and is the work of the imagination.
No, I assure you. It was not long after your trial. He was a Woolwich cadet. He blew his brains out so that he wouldn't live to shame himself or bring shame on others. He left a letter for the coroner.
Well, of course he did. And you should have sent your poem to the coroner, too. Art deals with exceptions, not with types. Facts deal only with types. Here was the type of young man who shoots himself. He read about someone shooting himself in the Evening News, so he shot himself in the Evening Standard. Oh, soon, and better so than later, after long disgrace and scorn, you shot dead the household traitor, the soul that should not have been born. Still, if he hadn't shot himself before reading your poem, he would have shot himself after. No, I'm not unfeeling. I dare say I would have wept if I'd read the newspaper, but that does not make a newspaper poetry. Art cannot be subordinate to its subject. Otherwise, it is not art, but biography. And biography is the mesh through which our real life escapes. I was said to have walked down Piccadilly with a lily in my hand. There was no need. To do it is nothing. To be said to have done it is everything. It is the truth about me. Shakespeare's dark lady probably had bad breath. Almost everybody did until my third year at Oxford. But sincerity is the enemy of art. This is what Pater taught me, and what Ruskin never learned. Ruskin made a vice out of virtue. Poor Pater might have made a virtue out of vice, but like your cadet, he lacked the courage to act. I breakfasted with Ruskin, Pater came to tea. The one impotent, the other terrified. They struggled for my artistic soul. But I caught syphilis from a prostitute, and the mercury cure blackened my teeth.
Did we meet at Oxford?
We once had a poem in the same magazine. Mine was for my dead mother. Yours was about the Turkish atrocities in Bulgaria.
Oh, yes. I swore never to touch Turkish champagne and to eat only Bulgarian delight. Do you eat cake? I invited 15 children from the village to celebrate Jubilee Day. We toasted the Queen and the President of the Republic, and the children shouted, Vive Monsieur Melmoth! I am Monsieur Melmoth here in France. We had strawberries and chocolates and grenadine syrup and the cake, and everyone received a present. It was one of my most successful parties. Did you come to any of my parties in London?
Oh, no.
No. But we must have had friends in common. Bernard Shaw? Frank Harris? Beardsley? Labouchere?
No.
Oh, Whistler?
No.
Stead of the Pall Mall Gazette?
No.
Well, did you know Henry Irving?
No.
Lily Langtry?
No.
The Prince of Wales? You did have friends.
I had colleagues.
Once I bought a huge armful of lilies in Covent Garden to give to Miss Langtry. And as I waited to put them in a cab, a small boy said to me, Oh, how rich you are. Oh, how rich you are. Oh, forgive me. I am somewhat the worse for cake. I have tried to give it up. Whenever I feel like a slice, I take a glass of cognac. Often I don't eat cake for days at a time. But the Jubilee broke my will. I allowed myself a social éclair out of politeness to my guests and remember nothing more until I woke up in a welter of pâtisseries.
Oh, Bosie. I have to go back to him, you know. Robbie will be furious, but it can't be helped. The betrayal of one's friends is a bagatelle in the stakes of love, but the betrayal of oneself is lifelong regret.
Bosie is what became of me. He is spoiled, vindictive, utterly selfish, and not very talented, but these are merely the facts. The truth is, he was hyacinth when Apollo loved him. He is ivory and gold. From his red rose leaf lips comes music that fills me with joy. He is the only one who understands me. Do you know Plato's description of love?
Even as a teething child
throbs with ferment, so does the soul of him who gazes upon the boy's beauty. He can neither sleep at night nor keep still by day. And a lot more besides. But before Plato could describe love, the loved one had to be invented. We would never love anybody if we could see past our invention. Bosie is my creation, my poem. In the mirror of invention, love discovered itself. Then we saw what we had made. The piece of ice in the fist we cannot hold or let go. You are kind to listen.
No, my life is marked by long silences. The first conjecture I ever published was in Horace. 6 years later, I withdrew it. Propertius I put aside nearly 50 years ago to wait for the discovery of a better manuscript. It seemed to me essential if there were the slightest hope of recovering the text. So far, silence. Meanwhile, I defended the classical authors from the conjectures of idiots and produced editions of books by Ovid, Lucan, Juvenal, and finally, of Manilius, which I dedicated to my comrade, Moses Jackson. And that will have to do. My sandcastle against the confounding sea. Classics apart,
my life was not short enough for me to not do the things I wanted to not do. But they were few, and the jackals will find it hard scavenging. I moved house 4 times. Once, it was said, because a stranger spoke to me on my train to work. It wasn't so. But it was the truth about me. In Diamond Jubilee year, I went abroad for the first time.
Oh, there's my boatman. It was he who told me you were a Latin professor. But he's profligate with titles and often confers professorships on quite unsuitable people, many of whom turn out to have chairs at our older universities.
I'm very sorry. Your life is a terrible thing, a chronological error. The choice was not always between renunciation and folly. You should have lived in Megara when Theognis was writing and made his lover a song sung unto all posterity, and not now, when disavowal and endurance are in honour and a nameless, luckless love has made notoriety your monument.
My dear fellow, 100 francs would have done just as well. Better a fallen rocket than never a burst of light. Dante reserved a place in his inferno for those who willfully live in sadness. Sullen in the sweet air, he says. Your honor is all shame and timidity and compliance, pure of stain. But the artist is the secret criminal in our midst. He is the agent of progress against authority. You are right to be a scholar. A scholar is all scruple. An artist is none. The artist must lie, cheat, deceive, be untrue to nature and contemptuous of history. I made my life into my art, and it was an unqualified success. The blaze of my immolation threw its light into every corner of the land where uncounted young men sat each in his own darkness. What would I have done in Megara? Think what I would have missed. I awoke the imagination of the century. I banged Ruskin's and Pater's heads together, and from the moral severity of one and the aesthetic soul of the other, I made art a philosophy that can look the 20th century in the eye. I had genius, brilliancy, daring. I took charge of my own myth. I dipped my staff into the comb of wild honey. I tasted forbidden sweetness and drank the stolen waters. I lived at the turning point of the world when everything was waking up new. The new drama, the new novel, new journalism, new criticism, new hedonism, new paganism, even the new woman. Where were you when all this was happening?
At home.
Couldn't you at least have got a new tailor? Are we going together?
No, I will be coming later.
You didn't mention your poems. How can you be unhappy when you know you wrote them? They are all that will still matter. Oh, but you are not my boatman. Sebastian Melmoth, à votre service.
Sit in the middle.
Of course.
Is there a chamber pot under this seat?
No.
What are you doing here, may I ask?
Classics, sir.
Oh, of course. What year are you in now?
My final year.
So am I. Indeed, for all practical purposes, I'm dead. And how are you?
I'm quite well, thank you, sir.
Propertius.
The first of the Roman love elegists. Actually, Propertius is not set for finals. I should be cramming. Everybody expects me to get a first, you see. My family, too. I'm the eldest, and I've always been a scholarship boy. I ought to put Propertius aside now, but we're already, all of us, so late.
Oh, by the way, the first of the Roman love elegists was not Propertius, strictly speaking.
It was Cornelius Gallus.
Gallus!
Really and truly.
But I've not read him.
nor I. Only one line of Gallus survived, the rest perished.
Oh.
But strictly speaking, which I do in my sleep.
He was first.
One line for his monument.
Virgil wrote a poem for him. How much immortality does a man need?
His own poetry all but a line, as if he had never been, but his memory alive in a garden in the northernmost province of an empire that disappeared 1,500 years ago. To do as much for a friend would be no small thing.
Yes. Well, Propertius mentions him, too. And lately, how many wounds has Gallus bathed in the waters of the underworld, dead for love of beautiful Lycoris? Lately. Modo, just recently. They were real people to each other, that's the thing. They knew each other's poems. They knew each other's girls. Well, Virgil puts it all in a golden age, with panpipes and goat herds and Apollo there in person. But you can trust it. That's what I mean. Real people in real love, bearing their souls in poetry that would make their mistresses immortal. And it all happened in such a short span. As if all the poetry till then had to pass through a bottleneck, where a handful of poets were waiting to see what could be done with it. And then it was over. The love elegy complete. Love, as it really is.
Oh, yes, there'd been songs, Valentine's mostly in Greek, often charming, but the self-advertisement of farce and folly. Love as abject slavery and all-out war, madness, disease, the whole catastrophe owned up to and written in the meter. No, that was new.
Oh, I'm sorry, they're calling me.
Picnic! Lucas! Honey!
I'm here!
Mo.
It's time to go.
I would have died for you, but I'd never have the luck.
Where are we going? Hades. Pull on your right, Jackson.
Do you want to take the oars?
Tendebantque manus vitae ulterioris amore.
And they stretched out their hands in desire of the further shore. Clever Boots was usually good for a tag. Thus Virgil, Aeneas in the underworld, the souls of the dead reaching out across the water, ripa ulterioris amore. You couldn't do better with a Kodak. And those who were unburied were made to wait 100 years. Well, I could wait 100 if I had to. 77 go quick enough. Which is not to say that I've remembered it right, messing about in a boat with Moses and dear old young Pollard on a summer's day in 79, or 80, or 81, but not impossible. Not so out of court as to count as an untruth in the dream warp of the ultimate room. Though the dog is still in question. And yet not dreaming, either. Wide awake to all the risks. Archaism, anachronism, the wayward inconsequence that only hindsight can acquit of non sequitur. Quietus interruptus by monologue incontinent in the hind leg of a donkey class. You're too kind, but I'm not there yet. And the unity's out of the window without so much as a window to be out of. Still shaky, too, from that first plummet into bathos, Greek for depth, but in rhetoric a ludicrous descent from the elevated to the commonplace, as it might be from Virgil to Jerome K. Jerome. If that is even a downward slope at a time of speaking, when is that? For walking on water is not among my party tricks. The water and the walking work it out between them. Neither dead nor dreaming, then. But in between. Not short on fact or fiction, and suitably attired in leather boots. The very ones that I was too clever for, which, here comes a fact, I have left in my will to my college servant. They are too small for him, but it's the thought that counts. And here is one to be going on with. In December 1894... Jerome K. Jerome, the celebrated author of Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of The Dog, made an attack on an Oxford magazine, The Chameleon,
which, he wrote, appeared to be nothing more or less than an advocacy for indulgence in the cravings of an unnatural disease. It was, he said, a case for the police. Oscar Wilde had given the chameleon a page or two of epigrams to oblige an undergraduate he'd befriended, Lord Alfred Douglas. Douglas himself had a poem, the one that ends, "I am the love that dare not speak its name." Jerome's article goaded Douglas's father into leaving a card at the Albemarle Club to Oscar Wilde posing as a sodomite, from which all that followed, followed. Which goes to show, I know what I'm doing, even when I don't know I'm doing it. In the busy hours between the tucking up and the wakey-wakey, thermometer faintly antiseptic under the tongue from its dainty gore-stoppered vase on the bedside cabinet.
What will become of you, House?
Cota mens youth, alas. Macherison isfan argo a meran otavuk, ethalista malen scotto.
I never took to it, you know. All that wainy, weedy, weaky.
When thou art kind, I spend the day like a god. When thy face is turned aside, it is very dark with me. I shall give thee wings. Thou shalt be a song sung unto posterity so long as earth and sun abide. And when thou comest to go down to the lamentable house of Hades, never, albeit thou be dead, shalt thou lose thy faith.
Wickedness is a myth invented by good people to account for the curious attractiveness of others. One should always be a little improbable. Nothing that actually occurs is of the smallest importance.
Oxford in the golden age. The hair shirts versus the aesthetes, the neo-Christians versus the neo-pagans, the study of classics for advancement in the fair of the world versus the study of classics for the advancement of classical studies. What emotional storms! And oh, what a tiny teacup. You should have been here last night when I did Hades properly. Furies, harpies, gorgons, the snake-haired Medusa. To say nothing of the dog. But now, I really do have to go. How lucky to find myself standing on this empty shore, with the indifferent waters at my feet.
John Wood was A.E. Houseman, and the young Houseman was Ben Porter in The Invention of Love by Tom Stoppard. Jowett and Stead were played by John Carlyle, Ruskin and Labouchere, Benjamin Whitrow, Pater and Harris, Robin Soames, and Postgate and Patterson, William Chubb. Jackson was played by Robert Portal, Pollard, Adam Barker, and Chamberlain, Chris Marshall. Oscar Wilde was played by Paul Shelley, Karen and the committee chairman, David Ryle, Ellis and Jerome K. Jerome, Paul Benzing, and Catherine, Emma Dewhurst. That was a radio presentation of the Royal National Theatre production, directed by Richard Eyre, with music by Dominic Muldowney. The radio production manager was Sarah Scott, and the director was John Tideman. The Invention of Love,